Case number 20-3306, USA versus James Thomas. Oral argument not to exceed 15 minutes per side. Mr. Jenkins for the appellant.
Mr. Jenkins, you may proceed.
Thank you. Esteemed panelists, as stated, my name is James A. Jenkins, representing the very respectful and appreciative James Thomas, appellant in this matter, who, as a result of his plea and conviction, was sentenced to 120 months consecutive to 60 months in federal prison. Now, as I hope I'm not too repetitive, but as I mentioned in my closing comments to the trial court after the suppression hearing, in almost 36 years of criminal practice, both as a prosecutor and defendant, this is one of, if not the weakest excuse for probable cause for a search warrant that I've seen. In reviewing the materials, I looked for physical evidence which might support that probable cause. The only thing offered by the government in support of the affidavit for the search warrant was one single trash pull that provided no drugs, no paraphernalia, no scales, no residue. The only thing they found were some disposable gloves that are pretty common in every household where the occupants clean their own bathrooms and sinks, and also some innocuous piece of plastic. As for any testimony to support the government's position, it dealt with the second search warrant for the top-notch barbershop, which was a lone, unidentified, unverified, uncorroborated, five-month-old statement from some jailhouse inmate. They didn't identify the inmate. They didn't suggest that he was reliable, that he had been used before, but they based the request for the second search warrant in part on the testimony that was 5 months and very stale. The incriminating phone recordings is another thing that they based their probable cause on. And even with the creative, imaginative interpretation, which agents frequently use, they couldn't show any secret drug jargon that supported their position. In fact, during the suppression hearing, which I know you're all familiar with, on page ID 451, I asked Jimmy Fields, the deputy sheriff and DEA task force member who testified, whether he suggested to Judge Lansinger that there were incriminating conversations between Ms. McQuillan, the original target of this investigation, and my client, Mr. Thomas. His response was yes, that he did suggest there were incriminating conversations. On the next page, I asked, can you give us an example of what kind of incriminating statements were made? His response was, in essence, no. Later in the same page, I asked, were there any incriminating conversations about drug trafficking between Ms. McQuillan and Mr. Thomas? His response was, to my knowledge, no. They then went into their creative interpretation and they claim this was incriminating when Ms. McQuillan contacted my client asking, what time does your shop open? I was going to leave early in the morning and come down your way. That's page ID 463. And on the next page, he indicated, I believe that they were talking about a drug transaction. It suggested that affiant believes that McQuillan was advising Thomas when she was leaving Clearfield County to meet him in Ohio at his shop in order to purchase methamphetamine. Quite a creative interpretation there. On page ID 465, there was
enough. Jenkins?
Yes, sir.
Okay, so assume we buy your argument on probable cause. Why wouldn't there be enough evidence for good faith, especially where a judge signed two separate warrants, I think within 24 hours, one laying out a wiretap where McQuillan, as you just noted, had gone 22 times to Ohio after telling people she was getting drugs, basically stuff. And then a second one where after they, for the second one, meaning the warrant of the barbershop, they've already found drugs at his house. They know that she was going to the barbershop to get drugs. A CI tells them 5 months before they were getting drugs. I mean, why wouldn't all of that be enough to show there's a fair probability, but you can't, maybe you can't look at both warrants for that. Maybe you can. But for probable cause or for good faith, you can, under our court in Frazier, look at everything the officer and magistrate judge knew. So why wouldn't that be enough?
Well, the 22 trips to Ohio would indicate that her phone, at least, made the trip to Ohio. They never had surveillance or any.
Okay, go back to my question, which is good faith. And we're not talking about certainty. We're talking about a fair probability if you're talking about probable cause. And good faith, it's much less, as you and I both know.
Well, I think if we're going to jump ahead to the criminal history that was included in that affidavit, I suggest that if you assume that it was unintentional, that it was certainly reckless to include allegations of criminal convictions that were absolutely false.
Mr. Jenkins, I'm not relying on those for the good faith analysis, right? So the question I have, just tell me on the question I have, which is the 22 trips plus the wiretap plus the fact that they found drugs at the house, plus the fact that the CI confirmed that he would sell drugs from his barbershop. Why isn't that enough on good faith? That's not bare bones. It's not any of the qualifications of good faith.
I think that the second search warrant is fruit of the poisonous tree from what they secured during the first execution of the first warrant. I know I'm not answering your question directly. I'm sorry I wasn't, I can't focus on that, but I'm trying to answer your question as best I can. And I do have a litany of other arguments that I wanted to highlight. I truly don't believe this was in good faith. The execution of the warrant occurred 1 minute after it was signed, according to what was timestamped on the document. The information from an unidentified, unverified, uncorroborated 5-month-old statement from some jailhouse inmate cannot be relied upon. It was stale. It was 5 months earlier. And I can't see that being even a scintilla of reliability on that particular issue, at least on that prong. I would hope that
why isn't that sufficiently reliable when you have in the same warrant that they had seized drugs from his house that day?
And again, that would have been, I'm sorry.
No, you go ahead.
Well, as I said before, I think that's fruit of the poisonous tree that emanates from the improper search of the home. And I know you indicated that Miss McQuillan was going to his barbershop to buy drugs. However, I don't think that's ever been suggested. She went to his house on the day where they finally set up surveillance. They didn't indicate whether she carried in a purse. They didn't indicate whether she brought anything out. There was no indication even that Mr. Thomas was home at the time that she visited.
Paragraphs 20 to 25 of the affidavit say that she went to the barber shop, she went inside, she left, she went back, she got home, she made a call, and then someone called and complained about the drugs, and she said she got them from the same guy she had gotten it from previously.
all innocent comments and actions, as far as I can tell, Your Honor. But to pick up where I left off, the phone texting, I believe, that occurred around the time of her visit to Akron suggested that she would be there in 10 minutes. And James Thomas then stated, cool.
And their interpretation. Mr. Jenkins, yeah. You may not be able to see the timer since you're on the phone, but your time is elapsed.
Okay.
You'll have your rebuttal time.
Thank you. Thank you. I appreciate it.
Mr. Reinke.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. Dan Reinke for the government. What really comes down to is probable cause for both warrants, the Patterson Avenue warrant and the barbershop, the top-notch barbershop warrant. The strongest evidence in support of the probable cause for Patterson Avenue was a fairly extensive investigation by Pennsylvania law enforcement authorities and then subsequently Ohio law enforcement authorities, which included T3 wiretap calls, GPS information from Sandra McQuillan's phone.
Counsel, I'm going to interrupt because I'm most interested in the barbershop warrant. And to be perfectly honest, it's odd to me that the officers would have submitted a warrant like this. They had a lot of information that might have established probable cause. They don't put it in the warrant. All the warrant says is that they recovered some drugs at his house and that he has a barbershop. And they saw him there and he locked it up. So far, I don't think there's any probable cause. You don't assume that because you find something at someone's house, it's at their place of business. And then there's this stale comment by someone of completely unknown reliability. And I mean, my own personal view is that this isn't enough for probable cause. So where do we go from there to persuade me that it shouldn't be suppressed?
Assuming the probable cause is lacking, based on what you identified, Your Honor, I think then we go to a good faith analysis of what, and under Christian and other cases in this court, the court can consider other things besides what was in the affidavit. And I understand what was in the affidavit was not extensive. It's interesting, and I'm sure that all the panel members noticed this, but if they just would have put in half of what they put in the affidavit for Patterson Avenue, which mentioned the barbershop, I believe at least two trips to the barbershop on July 2nd and then July 11th, I don't think we'd be having as much of an issue with it. But looking at what everyone knew, that it was reasonable, I believe, for the officers to rely in good faith on this warrant or on this search warrant affidavit. As was noted during Mr. Jenkins' argument, while the informant in the jail in February was not identified, his information was corroborated to a certain extent. He was able to identify the barbershop and where it was. He identified Thomas, and he identified the types of drugs that he had purchased from the barbershop in February.
What's your if you're arguing probable cause, and Judge White asked you about good faith, but it sounds to me like when you're talking about the reliability of that, you're arguing probable cause. What's your best case that the fact that the tips were corroborated means that the information is reliable?
Are you asking for a specific case?
Yeah. What's the best? You're saying, look, this information is reliable. And the reason it's reliable is he talked about meth. He talked about where the barbershop was. He talked about dealing from the barbershop. So law enforcement could corroborate those independent things to make sure the information was reliable. What's your best case for that?
Well, at least in the barbershop affidavit, they did mention Detective Callahan referenced that there had been a search earlier that day at Patterson Avenue, and they had found cocaine, methamphetamine, firearms.
I was asking for a case name, but that's fine. Okay.
Oh, I'm sorry.
So what else are they allowed to consider other than the warrant?
I think under Christian, they talked about being able to consider what everyone knew, really, what the magistrate knew, what the timing of the warrant. Here, the
Patterson Avenue. Christian or Frazier?
I think Christian talks about it, but I think Frazier also talks about it, Your Honor. But Christian, the unbanked Christian in 2019.
No, I'm aware of the case, but I think Frazier. This sounds like what you're talking about, which is you can consider everything the officer and magistrate knew.
Okay. Yeah. I'm sorry. But yes, so that's what they can consider. And the same judge, it was Judge Lanzinger, signed both warrants. The Patterson Avenue warrant was signed at, I think, 3:50 on the 26th. And the barbershop warrant was signed later, like 9:30, I think, that night. So they knew what was in the first warrant, and the first warrant, tied the barbershop into the drug conspiracy, much more, effectively than the second. As far as staleness, 5 months, while it's not recent in time, it's not overly stale when you consider that this was an ongoing conspiracy, and that the information that law enforcement knew was that Thomas was meeting with a drug purchaser at the barbershop. He did it at least twice, and there were phone calls before and after to kind of indicate what the subject of that meeting was. Also, finding at his house earlier that day drugs, as well as a substantial amount of money and firearms, also tends to indicate that the conspiracy is ongoing, which would also defeat a claim of staleness.
And is there any evidence that the officers involved in obtaining and executing the second warrant were aware of the first warrant and the search?
The officer mentions in the warrant that at the first that he was aware that they had found a certain amount of methamphetamine, cocaine,
right,
firearms.
But is there any evidence that he was aware of the warrant, or that, do we know the affiants were different on the two warrants?
They were, Your Honor. The first warrant was Detective Fields. The second warrant was Detective Callahan.
Okay, and do we even know whether Callahan was aware of the allegations or the information in the first warrant?
Callahan indicated that he was aware of the search and then the results of the search. I'm not sure he indicated that he was aware of everything in the first warrant. He tended to focus on the search and the results of the first search.
Thank you. But the judges were the same.
Yeah, Judge Lanzinger was the same judge. They were signed. six, 7 hours apart on the same day. They were filed at a different time. The one warrant was filed on the 30th. And this came up in the district court, but they were actually signed on the same day. As far as the two misstatements that were contained in the affidavit, the Patterson affidavit, and the criminal history, even if the judge, you know, held a hearing, had testimony, the Detective Fields explained how the illegal manufacture of drugs ended up being in the warrant, and that was a mistake by Leeds, which he said was generally reliable. The court found that credible. And as far as the substitution of cocaine for marijuana, Detective Fields just explained that was a typographical error and an innocent mistake on his part. He did not mean to mislead the court. But even if you take all that out of the equation, you take his entire criminal history out of the equation, there's sufficient probable cause in the Patterson Avenue warrant based on, and I'm sure this court knows that you've already referred to it, but based on the communications between McQuillan and Sue Hummel, and then the trips to Akron, and then the references to, you know, the methamphetamine wasn't good and I got it from the same person, as well as the on the, and they surveilled, they followed her twice to from Pennsylvania to Akron, I believe once on July 11th, and then that's when they followed her to the barbershop, and then on the day of her arrest, July 26th, they followed her, joint operation Pennsylvania and Ohio law enforcement followed her from Claremont County, Pennsylvania to Akron, to his house, where she went in for 30 minutes and then left. And there were phone calls that went along, you know, bracketed, well, at least for that one, before she got there. So with that evidence, I believe that the government's position is that there is a sufficient probable cause to support that warrant. And then considering all that with the second warrant, that there was a good faith belief by the officers when they executed it.
Does that conclude your argument?
It does, Your Honor, if you have no further questions.
Seems we have none. Mr. Jenkins, your rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. Under Leon, a good faith exception, such as suggested by the government, does not apply where the supporting affidavit contained knowing or reckless falsity. Now, this criminal history that was brought up suggested that Mr. James Thomas was convicted of illegal manufacturing of drugs. It could have taken that detective 5 minutes to go on his county website and determine that James Thomas was not the person who was convicted of that. He's got a different date of birth. My client is of a different race than the other James Thomas that they confused him with. And then to suggest that it's a typographical error to type cocaine instead of marijuana, that is reckless if ever there was any. Also, where the warrant was neither in good faith nor objectively reasonable, the good faith exception does not apply. As a prosecutor, I've seen many instances where we refused to go to a judge because enforcement officers didn't present us with enough evidence. This is one of them, although in this particular case, if you assume that it was unintentional, certainly the suggestion to the impartial magistrate was extremely reckless. And I ask the court to consider this strongly. Thank you.
All right. We appreciate the argument both of you have given, and we'll consider the case carefully.